creative journey. It's easy to get lost, but don't worry, you'll lift off. Sometimes you just need a creative pep talk.
Hey, you're listening to Creative Pep Talk, a weekly podcast companion for your creative journey. I'm your host, Andy J. Pizza. I'm a New York Times bestselling author and illustrator, and this show is where I share everything I'm learning about building and maintaining a thriving creative practice. Let's go. Let's talk about how to radically recover when you've lost the fun. This episode is for you if you're no longer having fun making stuff, your passion and enjoyment have been replaced by anxiety and pressure to perform, you always find yourself trying to outdo the last thing you made and you end up overthinking it, or you worry if you don't stay afraid, you're going to end up washed up. If you stay all the way to the end, I'm going to give you a game-changing practice that has helped me find focus and clarity for years in all the different creative outlets that I have with an exercise called Rename the Game. But first, let's talk about why you might want to completely do the opposite of what you're aiming towards right now. If your next season is looking busier than the last, take something off your plate by putting Factor Meals onto your plate. Eliminating extra decisions can free up brain power for other things like self-care and creativity, and Factor Meals makes eating well streamlined with always fresh, never frozen meals that are chef-crafted, dietitian approved, and ready in just 2 minutes. They have a weekly menu of over 35 options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, Vegan and Veggie. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week like breakfast, on-the-go, lunches, snacks, and beverages. I like their little vitamin-y shots. They're tasty. I like the spicy one. Head to factormeals.com/peptalk50 and use code peptalk50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code peptalk50 at factormeals.com/peptalk50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. I really needed to rehaul my website. I was talking to some web people, looking around, and I got intrigued by Squarespace's new Fluid Engine, partially because it just sounds cool, but also because it allows you to drag and resize and layer up anything you can imagine. I dove in, rebuilt my site. It's the most me site that I've ever had. I just absolutely love it. Launched it. Got such a great response. Some industry illustration and designy peers even reached out and was like, hey, who coded this thing, man? I'm like, y'all, I did it by myself. No coding with Squarespace's new Fluid Engine. I told him, like, you should go check it out. You're going to be surprised with what you can do. And I built this thing before Squarespace reached out to sponsor the show. So I was like, boom, easy peasy. I was going to tell you about this new site anyway. Go check it out, AndyJPizza.com, if you want to see what I did with it. If you want to try it yourself, make a site that's totally you, where you can build a portfolio, sell content and courses and all kinds of other stuff, head to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain with promo code PEPTALK, all one word, all uppercase. How is it that we have the same pattern happening over and over again where the artists that get all the way to the top, that have it all, that have this hit after hit after hit, end up falling harder than anybody else? Like, this is not news to you. You've seen it a million times. And a lot of these creators even that are at the very top, when they fall, either lose the ability to make creative work or have a hard time remembering what they loved about it or doing so without severe anxiety. And most of them, almost all, even if they are able to have some amount of creative output or have some amount of fun making work, they rarely are able to capture anything close to their best work ever again. Why does this happen over and over again? Of course, we have those that have risen so high and had such incredible praise after tons and tons of hits that they crumble under the weight of it and they collapse both professionally and personally. We see this with people like Kanye West or Britney Spears, like at the very tippy top global success, and then just crumble under the weight of that. But we also have people like Andre 3000 from Outkast, who, yes, did recently put out a flute record, and there are some people that are really into that. That's, you know, that isn't something that I'm really interested in weighing in on, but I know for a fact from his own many interviews saying that he too has just been racked with anxiety on this crowning of him as a creative genius, and that he has had too much anxiety around his primary creative outlet, which was rap, to really even create in that sphere any longer. And so we have so many examples of this. We have these artists that have this hot string of hits and get crowned creative genius, and it just crushes them. And the phrase that I hear in modern times around artists like this is this phrase, this person doesn't miss. And they have this pressure to never miss, never make a mistake. Every single is a hit. All hits, no misses. And I think it's this burden of never missing, never making a mistake that destroys artists. And I don't know a creator that doesn't want this string of hits, this place at the top. And I think there's some kind of disconnect here. When all of us can agree, we can all see that when you rise to the top, when you get to that place where it's hit after hit after hit, that it can cause you to lose it creatively or otherwise. And yet, I don't see a creator, very, very few, not shooting for that exact same thing. It's like sheep following the leader off a hill. It's the lemming conundrum of people going after this flame, even though it burns moth after moth after moth. And it makes me nervous because I see this massive disconnect. I know you see it, but why do we still aim for this flawless run where every project is a bigger hit than the last? And sure, it makes perfect sense. Like, who doesn't want to shoot for a hit every time? I get what that is, but shooting to not miss seems dangerous for us creatively because we have so much evidence that that not only is this not attainable for most of us, but that it leads to some kind of destruction. So I personally think that we should reject this aim of never missing and embrace something else. Because how can we look at these creators and see it happen over and over again and think, you know what? It's going to be different for me. I'm not going to be one of these creators that rises to the top and then crumbles to the bottom. I'm going to be the one and only Icarus that can fly all the way to the sun without going down in flames. I'm going to aim for the sun and I'm going to touch the sky and it's going to be all good. And I think maybe it's because we don't really think that it's possible for us to aim and hit that height. Maybe it's because we think we're not even going to come close to touching the sky. Like, I don't need to worry about flying too high, Andy, because I don't even have a chance of getting to that place. So what does it matter if I aim to never miss? That's just me hoping for the best. But I think even that, even if you don't have the possibility of rising to those heights, that aiming to never miss might be why you never get off the ground. Because never missing isn't just not the name of the creative game. I think it's the opposite. So there's a story that I try to review when I feel like I'm getting lost in this desire of never missing, and I get caught up in anxiety, and everything I'm doing is making me anxious, and I'm feeling this pressure to perform and have a hit that's bigger than the last. When I get into that zone, I like to review this story that you might have heard. You probably have heard. It's been told in a few different places in a couple different ways. The first time I came across it was from James Clear in the book Atomic Habits, and it's a true story, but it's also been said in two different ways to obscure details. So I don't know which exactly it was. I don't know if it was ceramics in reality and they changed it to photography, or if it was actually photography and they changed it to ceramics, but it doesn't really matter. James Clear tells the version of it that is photography. So he says, there's a teacher in this famous experiment that splits the class into two, and he gives the first half this assignment that says, for the entire semester, all you got to do is hand in one photo, the best photo that you can make for the entire semester, and your entire grade will be based on how good this one photo is. Now, the other half of the class is graded not on the quality of one photo, but the quantity of how many photos they can submit. That their grade will be based not on how good the photos are, but how many photos they can take and submit in a single semester. And so after that semester, when it's all said and done, they've all handed everything in, they have these outside photography experts come in and grade all the photos. And consistently, the highest ranked photos are the ones from the quantity half of the class. The idea or the takeaway is that creativity flourishes not from overanalyzing, not from aiming small and missing small, not obsessing over the perfect hit, making sure that everything that you produce and everything that you publish is flawless without a miss, but rather the opposite. So I'm a fan of Dr. Rex Jung, who is a neuropsychologist. I believe that I discovered his work on the On Being podcast, and he has a really great TEDx talk all about creativity. It's really interesting, highly recommend it. But one of the things that he talks about in there is this same phenomenon as the one with the photography, but through the lens of a different creative outlet, which is scientific paper publishing. And I think we can all agree that scientific breakthrough requires a whole lot of innovation, a whole lot of intuition, and a whole lot of creativity. And he makes the argument, and I would make the argument too, that science papers being published is as creative of an act as photography or ceramics. And he goes over what they found when they looked at the science all-stars that had published the most widely cited and celebrated papers, and found that the scientists that were at the very top, the ones that had the most hits, also published the most duds. And so the scientists that were able over their lifetime to continue to publish papers and to continue to make breakthroughs are the ones that also continued to make misses. What does this mean? It means that the name of the creative game is not never miss, but the opposite. Most misses win. That's a completely opposite way of thinking creatively. And if you have lost your love for making stuff, it's possible that you've allowed the pressure of never missing to change the game and ruin it for you. So if you're out here playing creativity like it's like the goal is to be judged on how few shots you take, how few misses you have, if you're anxiously worrying about whether or not your next song is going to be bigger than the last song, you're playing the wrong game. That's not the aim of the game. That's not the name of the game when it comes to creative work. So in reality, the creative game is more like soccer than golf. You know, in golf, every swing you take that's not a hit, that doesn't get you closer to your goal, gets counted against you. And the whole name of the game is the fewest amounts of swings, the fewest amounts of misses. But that's not creativity. I think creativity is much more like soccer. So I've been getting into soccer. I can't believe it. You can't believe it. And but authenticity is paramount to me. So I'm telling you right now, I tried my entire childhood to get into sports. My family is crazy about sports. I've mentioned on this podcast before that my little brother is actually named after Michael Jordan because we were crazy Chicago Bull fans. And I say we, but I mean them, because we went to so many Pacer games. We lived in Indiana. I saw Michael Jordan play. I do think Michael Jordan, see, witnessing some of his dominance was cool, but I could never pay attention for very long. I would even go to a Pacer game and look, I wanted to be a good boy. I wanted to be, bond over the stuff that my older brother and my dad liked. I tried to get into sports and I just couldn't. I just couldn't watch it. Didn't interest me. I have all kinds of theories of what might be going on there. Like, why is it that I have been able to get super into soccer over the past year and a half and not basketball? I think the stakes are just higher. I don't know. I think that's part of it, is that every goal is make or break. So you got to pay attention. Whereas in basketball, it feels like you don't really have to pay attention until the fourth quarter because there's hundreds of points. And that's where it really starts to heat up, is like the fourth quarter or the last few minutes of the game even. So I don't know. I really don't know. But I can honestly say that I have gotten super into soccer. And, it was also easier to get into maybe because our team in Columbus, the Columbus Crew, is super successful. And they won the whole league last year. So maybe that also helped me easily get into it. But either way, I got super into soccer recently, and we watched almost every single game, not all in person, but a few in person and lots at home. And I've been loving it. And I think that there's a takeaway for creativity. And if you watch it on TV, you're going to see this thing pop up called XG. And XG is expected goals. And the expected goals is based on this machine learning, based on the way things are going in the game. They have a theory of how many goals each team is going to play, and it changes throughout the game based on the choices that they make. And one of the things that increases your XG, increases your expected goals in a game, is how many shots on goal you have. How many, and I, look, I'm new to the game, so I think shots on goal means shots on the goal, shots that you took. And I looked into it a little bit, and It's not as simple as this, but generally, your amount of points correlate with how many attempts you make at the goal. And the same is true for creativity. The more attempts that you make, the more likely you're going to make something worthwhile. And it's why when you get at the top and all the eyes are on you and everyone's celebrating what you're doing, everyone's saying you're a creative genius, that it's super easy to let that pressure lock you up, because now you've got to maintain this situation where you never miss. And I'm watching this happen in real time as we speak to one of my favorite artists that I've followed since the very beginning of his career, The Weeknd. And I was thinking about The Weeknd, and the first thing that occurred to me was, you know, how many of the R&B singer The Weeknd's employees have been fired when he's like, hey, do you have availability for this? We're going to do an extra practice session next week, or can you come into the studio? And like, how many assistants have been fired for saying, you know what I'm doing? I'm just working for The Weeknd. And they're like, all right, get this guy out of here. Dad jokes, I don't know. But that's the first thing I thought of. But The Weeknd, right now, if you don't know The Weeknd, I don't know where you've been. Maybe you don't know him by name. I'll give you that. But I know that you know his singles because they have billions of streams on Spotify. And currently, he is the number one most streamed artist on the planet. Okay? And it has been thrilling to watch this guy rise just hit after hit, just crushing it. I think it was 2011 when his first mixtape came out. I saw an something that tipped me off to it. And I listened to that first mixtape. It's still honestly my favorite of all of his work. And, you know, I'm a truly hipster doofus for loving the early stuff the most. But I think I can defend myself. Like, that first mixtape, it was just unlike anything I've heard before or since, because it's this very, in some ways, very like straightforward take on R&B pop music. It's this kind of very, true to the form kind of approach. Like, it's got this Michael Jackson vibe. I know that he was channeling some R. Kelly as well, which, you know, nowadays is not a good thing to say. But he had this very kind of like legitimately squarely within what makes R&B R&B. And also at the same time, pulling from indie music and more avant-garde stuff and taking samples from Cocteau Twins and Beach House and mixing also in that first record, a lot of mixture with R&B singing and more hip hop, like rap stuff. It was just phenomenal. And other than the fact that it's kind of depraved in its lyrical content, I highly recommend it. Some of my all-time favorite songs are on that first mixtape. And I sent it to my brothers, who are huge R&B fans. They went super hard, were playing it over and over again. And it's been incredible to watch him go from that, release a couple more mixtapes, get on a major label and have this big debut. And then the next one has even these giant hits. And then the ones after that have bigger hits. And then he gets into movies. And it's just this huge explosion all the way to being the number one most streamed artist in the world. And when you see that, I don't know what you feel. Because when you look at someone like Taylor Swift right now or Beyonce right now about to release his country album, I feel nervous because historically speaking, there's very, very, very few people. I have a hard time even thinking of any that reach number one, reach that place of never missing, of always straight hits that don't crumble under the weight of it. And I'm worried that we're seeing the first fruits of that right now, because guess what? The Weeknd just did a show for HBO and it was universally panned critically. Like, I didn't watch it. It's not really my kind of thing. I also don't want to see, I just don't want to really see him in that light because I'm a fan. But is it the beginning of the end? I hope not. I hope that he embraces missing. I hope he embraces HBO, that it's called The Idol, I think. I hope he embraces that as like, yeah, that was a miss. Took a shot and a miss. That's what it's all about. That's the name of the game. And so what do we do? How do we change the way we approach it? When I look at myself and I can feel that anxiety, I can feel that pressure of I need to perform, I need to make this better than the last thing I made, try to remember that that's not the name of the game. So here's your CTA this week. Every single week, I try to give you a CTA, a call to action, or a call to adventure, depending on your metaphorical persuasion, which one you want to do, the literal or the metaphorical creative call to adventure. I personally prefer to see creativity as a kind of quest. And every single week, I try to bring you not just a cool idea, but also a way to put that idea into practice right now, right after this episode, so that it doesn't remain just a cool idea, but it can actually help you push your creative journey further. And so this week, your CTA is Rename the Game. And I'm very excited about this because this is something that I didn't realize I was doing. It was kind of an unconscious thing that made a massive difference in my life. And it's something I return to over and over again. And so if never missing is the opposite of the creative game, then I think we need to rethink how we talk about it, how we think about it, and ultimately how we name it as creators. So think about it like this. If you had a kid and they were playing soccer for the first time, they'd never really seen anything about soccer, they don't really know about it. If the kids told that kid, this game's called handball, that wouldn't be very nice, would it? Probably be bullying of some kind. Why? Because if you tell a kid that this game is handball, they are not going to do a very good job. They're not going to have a very successful game. In fact, if they think it's called handball, what are they going to do? They're going to pick up the ball. They're going to smack the ball. They're going to touch the ball. They're going to hold the ball. It's not going to be good because guess what? All of that is illegal. All of that is the opposite of the aim of the game. And if a kid found themselves in that scenario, they're not going to just have a bad game. They're going to be so humiliated that they may never pick up a ball again, which is okay when it comes to soccer because that's not the point, but they don't know that, okay? Be nice to them. They thought it was called handball. And so if that was you, if your kid had that experience, was bullied, told that soccer was handball, you probably wouldn't stop with telling them, hey, actually this is called soccer. It's mostly played with your feet. You'd want to rename the game as accurately as possible to undo that damage. And that's where we are creatively. If we're living in this zone where never missing is the supposed name of the game, we can't just be like, it's okay to miss. We need to rename it completely. And so you're not going to say it's just soccer. You're going to say, hey, everywhere else in this world, this game is called football. Why? Because it's played with your feet like 95% of the time. And so you're going to try to name it something that will keep top of mind. What is this thing all about? And while we're on this subject, let's just talk a little bit about American football just because American football is a complete mind game. And I kind of feel like I have a conspiracy theory that it's named football actually to kind of create a perfect trap for mansplaining. Because if somebody just saw it for the first time, they're like, man, there's a lot of holding of balls here. Like, that seems like the thing that we're doing here. Like, don't fumble, keep hold of it as long as you can. Catch it, hold it, don't let it touch the ground. Very little to do with kicking the ball or anything to do with your feet. And I actually saw this Swiftie before the Super Bowl was explaining football to people that maybe hadn't really dug in before. And she said that, hey, if this is your first time, you're watching because Taylor's dating this super football player, Travis Kelce. Here's what you need to know. They're going to tell you that there's four downs to get 10 yards. And what they mean by that is four tries. And I thought, oh my gosh, just naming it the right thing instantly helps clear up what this is all about. The amount of times when I have reluctantly tried to explain it to a friend or a British person that was watching it for the first time. And I'm like, yeah, they get these things, four downs, and you know, they get four downs to get 10 yards. And instantly your brain just like, what downs? What does it mean? Like, are they supposed to put it down? Like, no, it can't go down on the ground or then you don't get it. Like, no, four tries. You get four tries holding the ball to get 10 yards. If you do that, you get to start over. You get four more tries. You got to hold the ball all the way to that area at the end that they call touchdown, but you don't want it to go down. So why do they say it? It's to do with the patriarchy. Is it no wonder that, you know, the best team in the league for the past couple decades are Patriots? It's a little bit too close. It's just it's a conspiracy. I don't really think that, but I do think they should change the name because it's ridiculous. But if you want to course correct, the best thing you can do is to rename the game something that accurately depicts that tells you what you need to be thinking, what you need to be doing, what you need to be focusing on so you can keep it top of mind, keep that goal, that aim in your targets. And so here's what I want you to do. It's something, like I said, I've done this a few times just on an unconscious level. I have renamed all the games that I play without realizing it. So three games that I play are illustration, public speaking, and podcasting. And over the years, I have, without realizing it, renamed all those games more accurately to what I think they're about. So illustration, if you think illustration, most people think drawing, which makes sense. They are often drawings, they're pictures, picture making, that makes sense. But there is a dramatic difference between illustration and fine art and painting. Like, they are not even close to the same thing in their purpose, in their aim. They're as different as golf and soccer. And how you approach them needs to be different. And so eventually, the more I illustrated, the more I dove into that and kind of wrapped my head around some of the philosophy about what is illustration, what's the purpose, what am I trying to do, I started calling it by my favorite definition I ever heard, which is writing with pictures. Because it's so much more accurate to the game. I wanted the aim of the game and the name of the game to be the same. For public speaking, me and a friend renamed public speaking as lay down tragedy, and that it's in some ways the opposite of stand-up comedy. I have a theory that stories are essentially the other side of the coin for jokes. They have punchlines, but their punchlines, instead of eliciting a involuntary reaction of laughter, it elicits an involuntary reaction of crying. It could be tears of joy. It could be, you know, truly tragic where you're crying because something's sad. But ultimately, I think the purpose of story, live storytelling, is to have that welling up feeling and lay down tragedy being the exact opposite of stand-up comedy. That's how I've thought about it over the years. Now, when it comes to podcasting, here's what I realized. I realized that when it came to podcasting, especially the kind of podcasting that I do, which is mostly solo episodes, I've realized that I didn't have, it doesn't have a big enough history to really understand what this medium wants. And I thought a lot about how there's these times where you see a TV show and you're like, you know, when I watched Moon Knight, the Marvel show, I felt like that's a show that should have been a movie. Like it wasn't, it didn't justify itself being a show, and it would have been better in a different format because different formats have different strengths and weaknesses. And I once saw someone say on Twitter that they should quit turning book series and books into movies, that they would work much better in the format of a TV show where you could really be thorough and every chapter could be an episode, every book in the series could be a season. And I think that's a really good argument because it has a compatibility there. So for me, as I was doing these solo episodes, the closest thing I could compare to them initially was audiobooks. But I also felt there was a disconnect because one of the reasons you might go to a podcast rather than an audiobook isn't just that they're free, but also that you're free to be more active and tune in and out. They're not as dense. You don't have to be as tuned in to a podcast as you do an audiobook. They're a little bit looser than that. And I thought it's not really an audiobook. And then eventually I realized like, oh, these are kind of like audio blogs. It's almost essentially what you would get in a blog, but you're getting it in audio form and therefore can consume it as you go about your day and you can bundle it with other activities. Like that's what makes podcasting so interesting to me as a consumer is, as someone with ADHD, it is one of the best tools in the world to bundle with those monotonous tasks like washing the dishes or mowing the lawn that really help elevate it and make it a dopamine-rich experience, which is what I need it to be. And so renaming podcasts, especially the kind I do, as audio blogs was transformative to me because it gave me clarity. Like, this is the aim of the game. And so that's what I want you to do. I would encourage you to embrace the name of the creative game is Most Misses Win, because I think the research is there to support it. Now, I personally think a piece of work isn't really finished until you've published it. And so if you are a creator who wants a little bit more control than that, you don't want to have tons of misses on your record or your back catalog, I recommend having a really healthy practice of side bands. And so if you're a musician, this looks like you're going to have your main project where you kind of enter that or you release stuff that you feel really confident is your best work. But the way that you get to that is by missing a lot in projects that don't matter as much and collaborative things. You see this with people like Bon Iver, Justin Vernon. He has tons and tons of side bands, tons of other collaborations, and you can watch him cherry pick things that went really well and bring that back into his main project of Bon Iver. I look at, you know, people like, I was just noticing the other day, like we have this history of people like Jimmy Tamborello from the band Postal Service. And he had a project before that called Dental or Dental. I don't know. People seem to say it differently in interviews and whatnot. Dental, where he was almost doing this kind of minimal viable product thing that you'll see people do in the venture capital space, where they'll invest in a bunch of different things and not all of them have to be amazing, but the one that starts taking off, they'll do a more significant investment in. And I'm sure Jimmy Tamborello would not like his practice to be boiled down into something that's compared to capitalism, but there's a similar principle here. So he was doing these projects where every single song on these dental records was with a different musician. It was a different collaborator, a different vocalist. And then the ones that were really successful, like Ben Gibbard from Death Cab, he did a whole record with. And he did a similar thing to a lesser degree with Conor Oberst. And I personally think, I wish Ben Gibbard would have kept doing those side projects, because it was that Postal Service record where it was really free, really open, no pressure. They didn't think it was going to be super successful. They were doing it for creatively pure reasons of just having fun and making the work, and the anxiety was gone that allowed him to make what he calls the best Death Cab for Cutie album of all time, which was Transatlanticism. And he directly attributes the breakthroughs for that album to the work with the Postal Service. So if I was Ben Gibbard, I would keep making side bands throughout the whole process to keep that looseness, to allow yourself to miss frequently. Because the research says the more you are willing to miss, the more misses that you publish, the more hits you're going to have. Creative Pep Talk is your weekly podcast companion for your creative journey. And hey, it's dangerous to go alone. If you're looking for a little creative community and accountability, we do a monthly live Zoom call with our paid Substack subscribers. You can sign up and join us at andyjpizza.substack.com, or sign up to our free newsletter so that you never miss a week of this podcast or a week of pushing your creative practice forward. I'm your host, Andy J. Pizza. I'm a New York Times bestselling author and illustrator. I do client work for the likes of Apple, Xbox, and Lego, and I travel the world pep talking teams at creative hubs like Warby Parker and Sesame Street. You can reach out about commissions and collaborations at andyjpizza.com. Massive thanks to our backers, Yoni Wolf and the band Y for our theme song and soundtrack, to Sophie Miller for content support, and until we speak again, stay pepped up.